cost of building the power tower would have been out of sight if we didn't have nanomachines to do the work. How can we prevent the split? How can we keep connected with Earth, at least until we're fully self-sufficient? He pushed back the door to his room, forming a scenario in his mind. Okay, we establish the legalities that we're a corporation based in Kiribati, and the Kiribati government doesn't sign the Nanotech Treaty. But suppose the UN or the World Court doesn't accept that. Suppose they insist that we've got to give up our nanomachines. And we can't, of course. Suppose they send peacekeeper troops up here to enforce their demands. Doug sagged onto his bunk. Geez, we've got to figure out a way to prevent that from happening. But how? Without thinking consciously about it, he flicked on the window wall screen hanging opposite his bunk. Instantly, the screen seemed to turn into a big-picture window that looked out at the floor of Alphonsus. Doug stared out at the scene for a few moments, then went to his desk and pecked at his keyboard. The window showed Victoria Falls, then an underwater scene from a tropical reef. Not satisfied, Doug finally got a live view from the top of Alphonsus's ringwall mountains that looked out across Mare Nubium. "Magnificent desolation," he murmured. The barren plain was empty. Not a sign that a human being had ever set foot on it, except for the faint glow of a handful of red beacons that marked the sites of the old temporary shelters marching off to the southern horizon. If Greg looked out there, Doug thought, he'd see nothing but barren wilderness. But I see beauty. I see freedom. I see the opportunity to explore and learn and grow and build the future. How can I make Greg see it the way I do? He was still wondering about the problem as he put on his VR helmet and data gloves, booted up his computer, and linked with his afternoon class from Caltech. Rocket Port. Doug always asked permission to come into the Rocket Port's flight control center. It was a tiny cubbyhole burned out of the lunar rock by plasma torches back in the earliest days of Moonbase, barely large enough for two controllers sitting shoulder to shoulder at their consoles. It always reminded Doug of an old-time submarine's command compartment, compact and crowded, jammed with equipment that hummed and glowed and gave off heat. Despite Greg's swath of new radiators, the flight control center was stuffy and sweaty. It even had a conning tower, sort of. There was a vertical tunnel that led up to a minuscule observation bubble, barely big enough for a person to stick his head up above the surface of the crater floor for a visual inspection of the rocket pads outside. The controllers had never refused Doug permission to come into the center, tight though it was. Usually, Doug clambered up the ladder to the observation bubble, leaving the controllers to huddle over their glowing display screens. Traffic was seldom heavy. The lunar transfer vehicles plied the route between Earth orbit and Moonbase on a monotonously steady schedule. Rarely were there two spacecraft on the pads at the same time, even though Moonbase boasted four pads for LTVs to land on, spaced equidistantly from the observation bubble. Standing on the narrow platform of the observation bubble, his chin barely above the crater floor's surface and his hair brushing the transparent dome, Doug watched the lander come down slowly, silently, its dirty white rocket exhaust splashing on the smooth rock pad, blowing dust and pebbles that rattled against the bubble's glass-steel dome. Doug could barely see the actual touchdown when the big, ungainly lunar transfer vehicle settled on its outstretched, spindly legs like an old, old man sinking into a favorite easy chair. From below, he heard the chatter of the controllers as they remotely manipulated the access tunnel to lock against the LTV's personnel hatch. To Doug, it looked like a giant gray worm blindly groping for its prey. The spacecraft that transited between Earth orbit and Moonbase had a human pilot aboard only when they were carrying passengers. Even so, the pilot was merely a redundancy required by archaic safety regulations. The controllers landed the craft remotely, as they did all the unmanned cargo carriers. Once the access tunnel was connected and pumped up with air, Doug slid down the ladder in dreamy lunar slow motion without touching his feet to its rungs and landed softly behind the two controllers. "Thanks, guys," he said. despite the fact that they both happened to be women on this shift. Without waiting for them to reply, he ducked through the hatch and padded quickly in his soft boots down the tunnel that led to the pit, the receiving area. The airlock's inner hatch was just swinging open as he got there. Two men stepped over the hatch's steel lip, both dressed in the olive-green coveralls of the Mining and Manufacturing Group. The next, another man wearing the pumpkin orange of the Science and Exploration Group, tripped over the combing. A newcomer, Doug realized. Despite his weighted boots, he stumbled and floundered, arms flailing. Doug went to him, grabbed him, straightened and steadied him. "I'm okay," the man said. Like most of the short-timers, he was in his 20s. "It's a little strange your first time," Doug said, "especially after a couple days of zero-G." "I'm okay," he repeated, scowling as he pulled free of Doug's supportive grasp. Doug watched him walk awkwardly away as if he were stepping on landmines. "He'll never make it here," Doug said to himself. "Too uptight to accept help. Probably too self-centered to give help when it's needed." Turning back to the hatch, he saw Bianca step carefully through, also in orange. Her round face broke into a wide grin at the sight of Doug. "Welcome back," Doug said, striding up to her, arms outstretched. "Hi," she said, shifting her travel bag so they could embrace in a welcoming hug. Half an hour later, they were in the cave, sipping fruit punch and catching up on the months since Rhee had last been at Moonbase. "I'm not just a grad student slave this time," she said proudly from across the narrow table. "I'm here to do my thesis work." "No kidding. If I don't run into any snags, I'll be Dr. Rhee this time next year." "Terrific," said Doug. He liked Bianca. Ever since their experience together on the first South Polar expedition, which was known now as the Brenhart expedition, Doug had felt that Bianca Rhee was one of his best friends. She had come to Moonbase twice in the past 6 months, for a month each time. They had eaten together, joined others for parties or meals, talked endless hours about their hopes and plans for the future. Nothing more. Sometimes Doug got the feeling that Bianca might be feeling lonely at Moonbase. Sometimes he thought he saw something in her eyes, in her voice, that made him feel as if she was, what, disappointed, sad, uncertain? Maybe she's a frustrated ballerina, Doug thought, remembering her shy confession about dancing. She had never brought up the subject again, so he hadn't asked about watching her dance. Doug couldn't figure it out, and didn't feel that he wanted to probe Bianca's psyche that deeply. "Is it sex?" he wondered. "But she's older than I am, and she's got her own life back Earthside. Probably boyfriends or lovers. Maybe her family's already picked out a husband for her. She's never brought up the subject, and it's none of my business. We're friends, and that's fine. No sense getting it all tangled up with sex." Doug was not a virgin, but he was far from experienced. He had dated now and then during his year on the Vancouver campus. Despite the so-called new morality that the politicians, the media, and even the university administration constantly drummed on, several times his dates had ended in bed. He had never had to push it. He just went along with the tide. He never considered that being good-looking, athletic, easygoing, and extremely wealthy made him attractive to young women. Doug simply did what came naturally. At Moonbase it was the same, yet different. There was a core of some 200 long-term Moonbase employees, plus a couple of permanent residents such as Lev Brudnoy and Doug's mother. The long-term lunatics tended to form solid long-term relationships for the most part, although there were a couple of loose cannons of both genders. Rumor had it that Brudnoy himself was quite a Romeo, or had once been. It was among the short-timers, the men and women who visited Moonbase for a month or so at a time, that most of the action took place. Doug had enjoyed a couple of flings, nothing major, nothing more than fun and games. "So what's your thesis about?" he asked.
"Well, originally I was going to do it on brown dwarfs. You know, super large planets that are almost real stars. With the equipment up here, I've been able to do a real thorough search for them."
"Have you found any?"
"I've got six candidates, but I'd need some ultra-sensitive infrared equipment to definitely identify them as brown dwarfs. They've got to be radiating at the wavelengths predicted by Chardron's theory."
"Sounds heavy," said Doug. She grinned again.
"Too heavy. Too big a subject. My thesis advisor